This is The Big Web Show, a live talk show about the web and the future of web publishing. This episode of The Big Web Show is sponsored by MailChimp, powerful email marketing. Build and manage your email lists, design killer HTML email campaigns, and send emails with confidence. Sign up for a free account, and you can store up to 500 subscribers and send up to 3,000 emails a month. And their new location-based technology gives you the power to send email campaigns that include geo-targeting, locally timed delivery, auto-translation, and more. Sign up today and see why everyone's switching to MailChimp. Check them out at MailChimp.com. This is episode number 10 of The Big Web Show. I'm Dan Benjamin. I'm joined today, as always, by my friend and co-host, Jeffrey Seldman. Hey, Jeffrey.
Hello there, Dan. How are you doing?
Doing great.
And today we have a really amazing guest, as we always do on The Big Web Show. We have CEO of 37 Signals, author of numerous books, creator of many worlds, Mr. Jason Fried. How you doing, Jason?
Good. Hey, guys. How are you?
Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Thanks for joining us.
Of course.
I remember I first heard from Jason Fried 1996. You were a young copywriter who had just started a company with Carlos Segura. And who were your other partners?
It was Carlos Segura, myself, and Ernest Kim.
Yeah, that's right.
Just three. Yeah.
And 37 Signals was, at that time, a web development agency, I guess, but instead of taking the usual approach, which you guys never do, you'd written 37, basically, essays or pieces of poetry that talked about how business is done on the web, how people actually use the web, and why a whole lot of already established practices, maybe it was 1997, I'm not sure, but it was really early days, how a lot of established practices didn't make a whole lot of sense to you guys, and you had a much better, smarter way of doing things. So you, right from the gate, you basically confronted the industry you were in, spoke to business most design sites at the time were speaking to other designers, right? Like, I made this amazing illustration. I've made these amazing icons. I'm doing this amazing animation in Flash. And you guys were just like, here's how things should work. And I don't know, you were like 12 at the time, 26 maybe? You were very young. I don't know what you were doing beforehand. But you guys, and you wrote to me. You said, I'd like to use something you wrote as one of our 37 signals. But you did it after you already put it up. You already put it up. So you put it up, then you asked permission, which I think showed confidence. And I said yes. And there you go. And you've never looked back.
I'm trying to find that one now. Oh, there it is. So if you go to 37signals.com/11, just the number 11, you will see what we wrote. Inspiration Jeffrey Zeldman there on the left side. All about copywriting. Something we've always cared a lot about, and we've always admired your writing. And so we were inspired by you to put this up. This is one of the first, like you were just talking about. If you go to 37signals.com/manifesto, you'll see the original 37 Signals site with all the 37 ideas on there. Wow. And like you were saying, you know, when we launched the web design company, 37 Signals, we looked around at everyone else, and everyone else is doing the same thing. Like, here's our portfolio, here's a bunch of colors and stuff. And we thought that we would be more about ideas. So our site didn't even have a portfolio at all. It was just trying to find people who shared similar ideas. And that's what the site was, and that's how we attracted the right kind of clients that would agree with us or think that we sort of were on the right track and we would sort of see eye to eye with. And it worked out pretty well for us.
In client services, it's definitely about attracting clients. It's really all about that. You have to be good at what you do, but if you get the wrong clients, no matter how good you are, you're just in a sort of an endless misery and hell. And if you find smart people that understand what you do and want you to do that for them, then you can be happy. And certainly that's what you guys were about first. How did the initial 37 Signals come together? What were you all doing beforehand?
I was just freelancing, website design, writing, that sort of stuff on my own. And I decided that maybe I wanted to build something bigger than just myself. At the time, it was myself and Matt Linderman, who still works for 37 Signals. And we were like, maybe there's something else we could do, make this bigger or whatever. And so I actually started looking around interviewing for jobs at bigger web design companies. So I interviewed at Organic online here in Chicago. They're, you know, a big firm. They had a Chicago office, just opened one. And the guy who interviewed me was a guy named Ernest Kim. He was the creative director at Organic Online in Chicago. And I liked Ernest a lot, but I didn't like Organic at the time. I didn't want to work there. But we sort of kept in touch. And about a year later, he'd had enough of working at a big web firm. So we started talking about maybe we should start something together. And we both knew Carlos Segura, who was just a mutual friend of ours. And he's a graphic designer, traditional print designer, and he was looking to get involved with web design. So he wanted to do web design. I wanted to do something slightly different. Ernest wanted to get away from the big firm and start something small. So we all three hooked up and started 37 Signals. That actually was in 99 when we officially launched the company, but we were talking about it a year or so prior to that as well. So that's how it all came together.
And where did you find office space?
We actually used Carlos's space. Carlos has a bunch of other businesses running out of his home at the time. And so he had he built this extra building next to his primary house where he would just kind of work. And so we all just basically shared one big desk in his office for the first year or so. And then we moved out into a different space for a couple years. And then for the past 7 years, we've been sharing office space here in Chicago with Kudal Partners. And that's been great. We're about 3 weeks away. We're going to move into our own office, finally getting our own space again after 7 years of sharing a space with Kudal. And they've been great and everything. It's just time for us to get our own space.
So we were talking that just about that a little bit just before the show. Is it that you've outgrown it, or just that you want something that's independent, or are they growing more?
It's a little bit of all three of those, actually. So we only have 5 desks here, and we have 9 people in Chicago. So we don't really have enough room for everybody. We also don't have really any privacy here. If we want to make private phone calls, we have to go out in the hallway. And it's just time for us to sort of have our own space, have enough desks for everybody at the very least, and have some private rooms and some private places to go make private calls if we need to. Further, Kudal Partners has been expanding, not necessarily with people, but their business. They have Field Notes. I'm actually sitting in their Field Notes shipping room right now. That's really blown up huge for them. So they need some more space for that and everything. And it's just time for us, I think, to get our own space. It's bittersweet because it's exciting to have our own office, but we're really going to miss Kudal. They've been just fantastic to us, and they're just great people. And it's really great to have them around and to be around. And it's been great. So we're just moving about 5 blocks down the street. So hopefully we'll still see each other quite often.
But, in typical fashion, you guys have gone and just as you often design apps and talk about the apps that you're building in the open, you've talked about the new office in the open too. You've got your floor plans up online. And what kind of goes in? What's the motivation for going into that much detail about what you guys are working on?
Well, we typically try and share everything that we're doing, whatever it is. And so we thought, with the office, we might as well share that too. It may not interest as many people as maybe talking about design decisions that we make with web design, but, it's all just part of how we do things. We share as much as we can. And we thought other people who might either be looking for office space or are just interested in the creative process, they might find the floor plans and the videos and the discussion about materials interesting. And so that's kind of why we did it. And, people seem to like it, but other people think it's self-indulgent to share that process. And I get that too, but it just is what it is. We're just sharing as much as we can.
I want to go through the history of 37 Signals and what you do now and everything, but let's go to that self-indulgence aspect a little bit. I mean, you're a person on the web with strong opinions, and you're a company generally that when you express what you believe, you have people who are passionate followers of what you believe, which I know you're not looking for that, but you have that. And then you have people who are passionate detractors of what you like, who are offended that your opinions are so strong. Can you talk about that? I mean, anything that you blog about, it seems, if you say we're looking for, we don't want to do Photoshop comps anymore. Right. And all you're saying is we don't want to do Photoshop comps anymore.
Right.
That becomes 37 Signals hates Adobe, or, I mean, do you go out of your way to be controversial?
No, we really don't. We just say what we believe and say what we say. And certainly maybe our writing style can be a bit provocative at times and that sort of thing. So maybe it's a combination of that and being sort of outspoken and having strong opinions and everything. And the fact that we have a large audience now, there's over 100,000 people a day now who subscribe to our blog and read our blog. So, you know, when you have an audience of that size and you have an opinion, you're naturally going to have people who love it and who hate it. And we have comments on our blog, so everyone's free to speak up, and we don't censor people, and everyone can say whatever they want. So you sort of get, there's just this ripe environment for disagreement and arguing and debating and stuff. And it can hurt sometimes, you know, it's tough to get used to it, to have people, you know, when you say something that you don't think, like, for example, we just launched a new product a few days ago, this thing called Draft, which is an iPad app for sketching things and sharing them in Campfire. And we priced it at $10, which is high for an iPad app, historically. But, you know, it's still just $10. And, like, the things that people say about us, that we're, you know, robbing them and that we're greedy bastards. And, I mean, like, we're not going to make money off this thing really anyway. It's just, it's an iPad app. It's a very specialized niche thing. No one's going to get rich off this. So to call someone greedy for charging $10 for a piece of completely optional software is something I see where it comes from, but I don't really understand the controversy. So it's, you know, anything we say, we're definitely going to have people who just want to hit back at us. And maybe we've brought that on ourselves because we are opinionated. We've hit some people as well. So I get that, but we don't set out to be controversial. We just set out to say what we say, you know.
What is it actually might be useful to people who want to understand why something might cost $10, or it might be useful to other people who want to emulate your success and have their own ideas for creating. Like, what? I know you do everything in-house and you don't use other people's money to build things, but just developing something like Basecamp, even the first iteration, are you spending $20,000, $100,000, $1 million? Right. What does it cost to put together something like, or Campfire?
Yeah, well, I'll start with the last thing, Draft, just because that's the most recent thing. So this is an iPad app. We actually hired an external firm. We don't do iPad programming internally, so we or iPhone or whatever. So we hired a firm called Overcommitted, and they also built our Hi-Rise app for iPhone, and also built something called Ember, which is a Campfire app for iPhone. That project cost, I think, was like $4,000 to hire them to build. It's a very simple tool, about $4,000 to make it. So that's the initial cost of their time, and then it's our time, of course, to design it and come up with the ideas and the vision and the back and forth. So, you know, overall, you add up the time, probably, you know, $7,000-$8,000 or something for that sort of project, for that kind of app. You know, Basecamp or Campfire, those sorts of products take us like a good 4 months worth of time, and there's usually, you know, a team of three or so people working on it. So depending on people's salaries, you know, you can add that up pretty quickly. And that's sort of how that works. But we don't look at things that way. So we don't say this is going to cost us $50,000, so we have to recoup this sort of thing. It's more like for us, we're building things that we need anyway. So really, if no one buys it, if no one bought Draft for iPad, I wouldn't care because I need it and our whole team needs it and we use it every day. So for us, it was basically a $4,000 or $5,000 investment to build a product that we need anyway. Draft is worth $5,000 for us to save us the time that we're going to save using it. So for us, we're always building things that we need first, and if no one else buys them, that's fine. Although, of course, we hope people buy them, and people do. Lots of people do, which we're really grateful for. But really, at the end of the day, we don't look at the dollar and cents of the development project, but we look at the time. And the time's, you know, roughly 3 or 4 months to build a whole new product from scratch. And then after that, we're always iterating every day. We're making tweaks. And you can check those out. If you go to 37signals.com/changes, I believe that's the site where you can actually just follow along with our, let's see if that's it. Yeah, /changes, follow along with our change log. You can see every day we're releasing stuff, bug fixes, updates, tweaks, and whatever. So it's a constant iteration, constant momentum.
I'm just typing that, and actually, I was trying to calculate how much you were spending on the, you know, three people, 4 months. But
kidding.
So the whole philosophy of creating, and you've been very successful with this, creating something because you want to use it, is, I think, the way things used to get done, the way things used to be invented, say 100 years ago. But as marketing has become more professional, as marketing has dominated over research and development and over production, marketing is more important in most businesses today than the research and development of production, or it's more the driving force. And you know, production follows. You build what the marketers tell you the people want.
Right.
It's a very different philosophy, and it's very refreshing to see. I like to think that the best products or the best things are something that someone felt compelled to make. Like, you know, Disney really liked to make movies. You know what I mean? Not that, but, you know, and today they still make movies, but it's also a lot about, you know, filling a need for 12-year-old girls who have outgrown toy A but aren't ready for toy B yet. You know, there's a lot of that kind of stuff. You don't really do that. What's your, you don't do the traditional, and you've espoused a work philosophy of not doing traditional user-centered design. You don't, everything's for users, obviously, or there's no sense to it, but you don't do research and then do iterations and test, you know, before all kind of behind a secret cloak and eventually take stuff live. Instead, you sort of do everything out in the open. Can you talk about that a little bit and how it works for you?
Yeah, sure. So initially, whenever we build something, we try and do the best job that we can, that we know how to do. For ourselves, again, we're using the products that we build. So we're tough critics. We're very careful as best we can. I mean, there's definitely, I could pick out 1,000 flaws in our products. Our products are not perfect. But we try and do the best we can with whatever we're doing. And then we put it out there. And then we get real feedback from real people who are actually really using it every day for real projects. You know, my feeling is this, is that when we've done this before, we've asked or we've invited certain users in for testing something that hasn't been launched yet. And the feedback you get really isn't, we have not found it to be that worthwhile. Because until someone really is using something for real on something they need to get done right now, they don't really put it through its true paces. I mean, the thing that I think is missing with a lot of user testing is reality, is like the fact that someone's actually stressed out today because they truly have to get a project done and they have to get something to their client tomorrow. And when they use Basecamp for a real project, they're under those stresses. But when you bring someone in to test something out and say, does this make sense or does this flow work or whatever, they're not under those same stresses. They don't have the client calling them and screaming down their neck and the whole thing, or breathing down their neck. So I just feel like the best thing to do is do the best you can, put it out there for real, get real people using it on real projects with real clients in the real work environment under real stresses, under real time constraints, and then making changes and tweaks and iterations based on that real feedback. So we do involve our customers in feedback and feedback loop and making the products better, but it's after we've launched them and not before. And that's kind of the difference between the way we do things and maybe some other companies do things.
And Dan, when we do the final version of the show and put it up in iTunes, can we take out the word real and replace that with a different word? Because I think...
yeah, I'll work on it. I'll get right on that.
Okay, because obviously you wrote Getting Real. That was a big success for you guys. Can we talk about writing a little bit?
Yeah, I'd love to.
Your first book was Defensive Web Design. You were still, at that point, mainly a web design shop, and you were kind of known for, you were kind of masterful at showing other people's websites and going, here's what we would have done. Like, I think that was the genesis of the book, right? You said, I was trying to buy something today and it failed. Here's how I would have solved this instead. I'm expressing this badly, but
I'll fill you in on the series of exercises.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. The book, so Defensive Design for the Web, was on New Writers. It's still available. And it was a book about the bad side of the web, the bad experiences that people have. A lot of web design books are about how to make things look good and work well, and that's great. But there wasn't a book at the time, and there haven't been many since, about the other side, which is when things go wrong, designing for when things go wrong. How do you write an error message? How do you prevent an error message from happening in the first place? You know, how do you deal with search results when there's zero results? You know, all sort of the ugly side of things, the things when things go wrong, how do you design for that? And that's what that book was about. So we looked at a bunch of different sites and we said, you know, hey, these guys do it really well. These guys do it poorly. What can we learn from both of these examples? And that's what Defensive Design for the Web was. So it's definitely a book about web design, but specifically about designing for when things go wrong on the web. And that involved a lot of copywriting and involved a lot of design and all that stuff. So that's what that book was all about.
Do you run your agency like a university? in a way, or like a university course?
What do you mean by that specifically?
Because it seems to me that like, do you step back and go, come on, fellas and ladies, let's look at this. What are they doing wrong here? Like, kind of like Socrates, like, what do you... Here's the FedEx.
God, I wish I was like Socrates.
I mean, I do a lot of kvetching, especially with Apple products, because Apple products are so amazing that, like, when I'm the one person in the world who has some weird usability problem with the new iPhone or whatever, you know, I kvetch about it, and I don't know how educational that is.
It's fun to read, I can tell you that.
Yeah, that's great. But, you know,
here's what we do. I mean, we're always sharing. So we use Campfire all day, which is another one of our products, and that's where we kind of talk all day long internally about everything, the things we're working on, the things we like that we see externally, the things we don't like that we see externally. We're pasting in screenshots and talking about stuff all day. There's probably like a dozen external examples of, maybe that's a bit of a stretch, but close to 10, let's say, external examples of things that we see that we like. You know, hey, this is a really cool way that these guys did this thing for signing up, or hey, this error message really sucks, or hey, this is a great error message, or this is a great bit of copywriting. And so we're constantly sharing things that other people are doing amongst the whole company all the time, so we can learn from them or just like be aware of them and observe them, both good and bad. So that's, you know, I found that if you just kind of always point out the negative stuff, it turns into sort of an ugly scene. And I think it's great to admire other people's work and be really conscious of the great things that are being done outside of the things that we're trying to do and learn from that and be inspired by that.
Definitely. I always, you know, you talk about liking my copy. I always thought it was really important to have some flavor in those little instructional texts. And you know, and Flickr has come along and done the same thing. You've done the same thing. One of my favorite things in Basecamp when you were in the old days in Basecamp when you were and I think maybe this still happens, but now you've got the universal sign on. But before that, you'd be logged out and you'd come along and it would say, just sign your name and just sign in and we'll send you right along. And it was like that, and we'll send you right along seemed to me like a little pat on the back or a little snap of the towel in the locker room. It just seemed like this little friendly extra thing that didn't need to be there, strictly speaking, wasn't necessary for the user to understand, but it seemed like a really warm, embracing, friendly kind of like, you know. And I think it made people, and it's like little touches like that that make people feel like base, you know, regardless of the flaws that you may see in Basecamp or the fact that it's, you know, doesn't have millions of rounded corners and little bevels and glows and all that stuff, it still feels like a fairly warm environment because of little touches like that, I think. You know, and it's the same with Flickr. I mean, they've just gone through a beautiful redesign, but even before their redesign, even when it was pretty, you know, about as plain as web design can be, it still felt like a real place because of these little copy touches. And that's always been a big part of what you do. How many people do you have doing that for you? Is that something that you do all of, or does everyone on your team write a lot of it, or how does that work?
Yeah, I do most of the writing. All the websites, all of our marketing sites, I write all those, and I write a lot of the stuff in the products. Ryan Singer, who's a designer here and product manager as well, he's been really getting into the writing thing. We're really trying to encourage all of our designers to be great writers. I mean, to me, writing and design, there is no difference between the two things. They are the same thing. You're either designing a sentence, or you're designing a screen, or you know, you're designing a word. I mean, I can't really design a word, but you can figure out which word is the right word. Just like, just like you figure out which color is the right color, which shape is the right thing, and which buttons, you know, all these things, it's all the same thing. So I think a well-designed product that's poorly written is not a good design product, actually. It's not good design if the writing's bad. So we're very conscious of that. Now, good writing doesn't mean you have to always be clever or whatever. It's, you know, we're always trying to be as clear as possible. That's the thing we talk about internally all the time is clarity. But occasionally you can throw in that little thing that makes people feel comfortable, like there's actually a human who thought about this and not some program spit this out. And Flickr is a wonderful example. I really like Wufoo. I don't know if you guys have ever used that, but it's a forum
site. That's a great service.
They've got a great personality in their interface, colors, but also just the words they use, really fun. But I think Flickr is maybe the best early
example.
They're
the champions. I think they're the early champions of it. Like everyone noticed.
Totally. And that's been that's inspiring. So we do try and, you know, first and foremost, we try and be clear. I think when you try and be clever over clear, you get those backwards. So I think you got to be clear first and clever second. And if you have to throw one of those out, throw clever out. I think clarity is just so important. But when you have a chance to throw in something that's, you know, it looks like someone wrote it or someone did write it, of course, but you're someone was thoughtful about it, I think that's highly recommended and it does go far.
Or put the clever in a certain place. MailChimp has a thing. MailChimp is a mail service, right? And they're called MailChimp, and the chimp is their, you know, their identity. So they have a little chimp talking at the top of the website and making little, you know, little jokes like, why am I smiling? I'm not wearing pants, you know. And then they found that some people didn't like that. Some people said, you know, this is a business, and my clients look at this, and I can't have monkeys with no pants joking. So so they have a turn off the monkey button. I forget what they call it, but they got some little, like, no fun button or and so they even when they turn off the fun, they have fun turning off the fun, if you see what I'm saying. They give the user the option to turn off the fun, but they do it in a fun way. So, I think things like that are really important. Alfred Hitchcock said, a film should feel like the product of one mind, even though hundreds of professionals work on it. And, you know, like Peter Jackson's The Lord of the Rings, so many people worked on it. It's crazy, but it still feels like one mind is controlling the whole experience. And I think websites, I've always thought, websites should work like that too, no matter how many professionals are really involved. And I think, again, you guys talk about a little bit about the consistency between all the products. We were going through a naming exercise at Happy Cog the other day, and you know, it's pretty obvious, like, that you guys with Campfire and Basecamp, that you sort of had a whole world of metaphors at your fingertips, that you decided for whatever reason that it would be nice if business was like a camping trip, or business was like hiking in the woods or whatever. I mean, what was that creative process like, that where you, or did you just name something Basecamp first and then later scratch your head and said, hey, let's extend that metaphor? How did you come up with the product names, and how do you know that they work?
Yeah, it's more of the latter. I mean, Basecamp was just a name that sort of came to me. I was thinking about, you know, what is a project like? Because I didn't want to name it like, you know, Project Management 2000 or something like that, right? So, like, what is a project like? You know, a project is like it's sort of like this journey, and you kind of go away for a while, and you come back, and you go away, and you come back, and like, you know, you take rests, and like it was just this like a place you get together. And I was just thinking, like, it's kind of like climbing a mountain, sort of, and like, oh, Basecamp. Basecamp would be a great name for something where, you know, you go on this thing and then you come back to Basecamp. And so it just kind of popped in my head, and Basecamp kind of became the name for the product. And that was the first product. And then the second product we did was called Ta-Da List. So Ta-Da List had nothing to do with camping. But the third product was Backpack, and that was sort of like, okay, Backpack is like this sort of this personal version of Basecamp, kind of, sort of. It's something you bring with you with all the loose ends that you know. A backpack is this thing you throw stuff into, and that's what Backpack is. You throw stuff into it. It's about like all the loose ends, all your notes and tasks and ideas and garbage. You just throw it in a backpack, literally and figuratively in this case. So that's sort of where that name came from. And then we wanted to name, the next one was Campfire, actually, which Campfire, we're thinking it's a group chat tool. So Campfire was the perfect name for it. People sit around in a circle and talk, you know, around a fire, around a central thing. And that happened to have the camping metaphor built into it, which was great. High Rise was originally called Sunrise to, again, try and keep the sort of metaphor going. But as we looked into the trademark, we found out that Sun Microsystems is an incredibly litigious company, and they'll pretty much go after anybody in the software world that has the word sun in their product name. So we decided not to go there. And High Rise was one of the other words we were throwing around. And we ended up like, and I actually prefer High Rise anyway, but we were just trying to stay with the metaphor. But it's a good example of like, it doesn't really matter. So High Rise has nothing to do with camping. It didn't hurt the product, and who cares? So I think if you can keep the metaphor going for a while, that's cool, but I wouldn't be a slave to it. And we decided not to be. With High Rise, and working on a couple other things right now, like, you know, Sortfolio, which is another one of our products. That doesn't have anything to do with camping. The job board doesn't have a name. It's just the job board. And we're working on a new product right now, which we don't know what it's going to be named finally, but it's not probably going to be camping related. So, you know, if it's convenient, you go for it. If not, but I absolutely love naming things. To me, it's like one of the biggest thrills of having a company where you build products is coming up with names for things. I just think it's so fun. Mm. And I love it. And I've always found that the best names come to me early on in the process. And the longer I think about them, the worse the names get. And I've looked, you know, mm-hmm. I pull out the thesaurus and, you know, that never works. The thesaurus mm. never generates any good names. Mm. It's just like it's a name. It comes to you early in the process, and that's usually the one we end up going with. So I found that like it's better just to kind of spend a couple days and not months on something or even weeks, because it's not really going to get you anywhere.
Now, Jason, how important is the name that you pick to the product? I mean, most of your products, if not all of them, have been pretty big successes. Is how much do you think the name plays into that?
I don't know. I'm on the fence about a lot of things like this. Like, I don't think logos matter that much. I don't think names matter that much. I think as long as they're good, I know Jeffrey's going to come back.
all the designers in the audience are just saying, right. wait a minute. What show is this?
I care about logos. Like, we spend a lot of time on ours and the whole thing, but I don't think they really matter as much as designers think they want to matter. Now, this will be fun, so we can have a nice talk about this, but I do think if it's terrible, it matters. I think if the name like Project Management 2000 would have probably not worked for Basecamp, right? But if it was called, you know, but one of the interesting things about Basecamp is that originally a lot of people didn't call it Basecamp. We had five different domains that people could use.
Project Path,
Group Hub, C-Work, Client Section.
Right.
Client Section.
And so we got away with those. Now everyone's at basecamphq.com. But, you know, although the other domains still work. But those were
because
people,
Basecamp, did Sun Microsystem own basecamp.com?
Suncamp. Well, someone else owned basecamp.com. You know, this is another example. Do domain names matter? I don't know. Right. I don't really think so. I mean, I think Google matters. So if someone types in Basecamp in Google, we come up, and that's the domain that really matters today is Google. I think all these things like names and logos and domains, like if you can get a great one and you can come up with a great one and you can design a great one, that's better. But I don't think, unless it's absolutely crappy, I don't think there's a big difference between good and great when it comes to these things for most companies. Now, you know, you could say, and even tag, like, I think taglines are like fun to write, but they pretty much don't matter either, unless, you know, you're Nike, and then maybe it matters.
Just because do it, right.
Yeah, because you have that, like, you have this enormous platform, and you can, you know, make the tagline truly something that matters. But if you're, you know, a company making, you know, web-based software that's used by 10,000 people, no one's going to know your tagline, no one's going to remember, and it doesn't really matter. So I think a lot of companies waste a lot of time on things like that don't really matter up front. I love beautiful logos. I get a kick out of them. I think when I see one, I'm like, man, that is just badass. And when I see great names, it's badass. But I don't think they matter as much as designers think they matter.
The most important thing is to have good furniture, like from Design Within Reach, in your office. I think that's the key.
That's all
also,
that matters.
Also, like etched glass is really important.
It is.
No, actually, Jeffrey, I'll run with that, because that's actually a good segue to something else that I wanted to ask Jason about. Jason, when you were on the pipeline, we talked about this a little bit. But can you go into some of your philosophies and your thoughts about offices? And obviously, here you are building, you know, an awesome new office that looks like a place anybody would want to work. But you're pretty open-minded about how people spend their time in an office and whether they're virtual or not. You've got a lot of virtual employees. Can you talk about that? Because there's still so many people out there who say that just doesn't work, virtual.
Sure. So 37 Signals has 20 people, and 9 of us are in Chicago, and 11 of us are in 11 other cities around the world. And the 9 of us that are in Chicago, we're almost never in the office either. So maybe a few days a week we might see each other. And it's usually never all 9 people. One of the reasons is we don't have enough desks for everybody. But our feeling in general is that people should work where they're most comfortable. So if that happens to be an office, work at the office. If it happens to be at home, work at home. If it's a split, do that. If you want to work at the coffee shop, do that. Do wherever you want. If you want to work at a co-working space, do that. It doesn't really matter to me. So that's the philosophy. Now, the reason we're building a new office is to give people another option to work in a place that's built just for the way we work. So if you know, even though we're spending a ton of money on the office and the rent's expensive and the whole thing, and partially it's a luxury for us. It's a luxury purchase because we don't need it. but we think that it will make our work environment better for those who choose to work at the office. So I hope more people will come to the office, but just because we're spending the money on it does not mean that everyone has to change the way they work. That would be selfish on the part of the company to say, hey, you work better at home, but sorry, I want you to work at the office now because we spent $1 million on it or whatever. So it's really about just giving people another opportunity, another place to do great work. And we hope the office will help people do great work in ways that they couldn't necessarily do it before because of the way it's structured and the way it's set up. But still, the theory, the philosophy remains that you should work where you're most comfortable working because that's probably where you're going to do your best work.
So when you manage and work with a virtual team, you're still interacting all day long because of Campfire, right? I mean, in a way, you build products to simulate that all of you are in the same office at the same time, sort of like saying, hey, what are you eating? And what are you guys working on and all that kind of stuff?
The big difference is that with Campfire or with any product you choose, I'm talking about ours because we use ours, but any sort of passive tool like a chat tool, if I don't want to pay attention to you, I can put the chat tool away.
Yes.
Right? In a traditional office where it's very open and everyone's talking to each other all the time, it's very hard to get away from those interruptions. You can't turn everyone off, you know? And so that's why we prefer using something like Campfire, because if I'm busy, really busy, and I need to get stuff done, and I don't need to be part of the conversation, I can just quit Campfire or put it away or whatever, and then get back to it 3 hours later. I can scroll back and read the transcripts of all the conversations I missed when I wasn't around. So at my own leisure, I can go back and find out what people were talking about. So that helps to reduce interruptions, which is something we're very obsessed with, is reducing interruptions, because that's where work doesn't get done. Work does not get done in an environment where there's interruptions all day long. And that's why most people aren't working at work anymore. They're working at night, at home, or on the weekends, or really early in the morning when no one's at the office, because during the day, they're just being interrupted all day long and they don't get anything done. And we don't want to be in an environment like that. So Campfire helps that. And the new office is structured in a way that we have these private rooms for people to go if they want to make noise and be isolated. We spend a lot of money on soundproofing and acoustical materials to keep the sound out of the rest of the space so people can work quietly, but also have a place to go if they do want to talk to someone else.
See, that's great. I hated the dot-com era in part because I had to give up my office, right? Because we were all like transparently, openly working in the same cheap space, right?
Right.
Whereas I came from advertising where I could basically stumble in at 10:30, close my big door, call my light up a cigarette, call my freelance client, and then go for drinks. And nobody
would
scotch
during the day too, or not? Or scotch after work? When was that?
Yeah, it's totally all that stuff's true. All that stuff on that.
You know what? What just seems crazy to me are all of the companies that still, even today, that you'll see in these co-working spaces in the cool areas of San Francisco, where there are people literally just on like fold out tables staring, you know, at each other with five people per table, all of them on the phone, all of them talking. It just, that to me seems like pure madness. It's amazing anything gets done. Why is it still so rare for companies to embrace this kind of thinking? Why, when they can say, okay, we're going to follow your advice about meetings, we're going to follow your advice about X, Y, and Z, this is the one thing that people are still so hesitant to try. Why? Why do you think that is?
Well, meetings are a pain point, but they do have value, you know, and there are certain kinds of businesses that require meetings.
There's some of that. Yeah. There's a lot of things having to do with just tradition and managers. I think a lot of it has to do with managers. Managers feel like their job is to oversee people, and the C is the important part. You know, if they can't see you, then they're not managing you, and then what are they doing? And so there's a lot of that going on. There's a lot of just people unwilling to try, and they think that if someone's not around, that means they're not doing work. If they're at home, they're distracted. Well, the truth is there's probably more distractions at the office than there is at home for a lot of people during the day. So I just think it's tradition. I think over time things will change. In our new office is a mixture of open space and private spaces. And I think that hopefully we'll see how it works. But the theory is that's a good combination, because I do think there's some value in being able to see everybody and, you know, being able to see what people are up to, but also being able to get away from everybody and have quiet time or work with other people in a quiet environment where they're not interrupting other people. So I agree with you regarding the co-working spaces. Some people love them. I don't know. I have never worked in one. I wouldn't work well in an environment like that. But some people might. And so, you know, if that works for them, great. I think, though, the people have to really figure out if they're actually working or not, or they're just doing stuff, because there's a difference. And I think, you know, a lot of people go to these co-working spaces and they're all talking all to each other and riffing and stuff. And they think that that's collaboration, or they're shooting creative ideas off one another. Mm. And that might all be fine. But if you don't actually do any of those things that you're talking about, it's not really working. It's just BSing. And that's all right. But just be aware that there is such a thing as over collaboration. And interruption and collaboration are not the same things. And so you really, there's a time and a place for all this stuff. And if your whole workday is based on chatting with other people all day, then what are you going to actually get the work done? You're probably not. And so it's a form of procrastination in many ways, just to continue to brainstorm. And so we try and do stuff instead of just talk about it. We try and do it as much as we can. People sometimes get the wrong impression of us. And I get it, going back to your initial questions about how opinionated we are, but we're just talking about the things that work for us. We just don't couch everything by saying it depends, you know, it depends, or in my opinion. I mean, that's just a weak way of talking. So of course, reasonable people understand that when we talk, we're simply sharing the things that work for us, and everyone's mileage varies depending on their environment and who they are and the whole thing. So we're just putting our ideas out there. You should take our ideas, your ideas, someone else's ideas, and come up with whatever you think works best for you.
Cool. And I think a lot of people love the straightforwardness of the way you present your ideas and the lack of hedging. I think that's very internet too, just putting it out there, which actually reminds me of one of my favorite stories that Jim Kudal tells. Can I tell this story? I won't tell it as well as Jim Kudal, but he's not here.
He's actually down the hall, so we could maybe even bring him in here if you want.
Okay, well, just don't embarrass me if I tell this wrong. So Jim Kudal and Jason Fried are at South by Southwest or another, let's say South by Southwest, right? And people keep coming up to Jason Fried and going, wow, you're Jason Fried. Oh, I'm such a huge fan. I love Ruby on Rails. Oh my God, you guys are so awesome. And this is happening over and over again, and nobody's coming up to Kudal. And finally, Kudal says to Jason Fried, you got a lot of fans. And Jason Fried says, yeah, but they're all guys. And then this beautiful woman runs up and says, oh my God, you're Jason Fried. And so Jason blushes and says, yes, I am. And she says, my brother loves you.
Yeah, that's the curse. Yeah.
Why is that? Is it Ruby on Rails? Why all the boy followers?
Like, I don't know. I think, you know, obviously you go to conferences in this industry and it's, you know, 98% male. I just think it's, for whatever reason, that's just what's going on in our industry.
Come to an event apart. It's 50-50.
Yeah, I've been to one.
As you spoke for us, yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, like Event Apart, Jared Spool's events, you know, there's a good mix actually at those. But yes. a lot of industry events are not mixed very well. There's a lot of, it's mostly like male dominated. And, you know, I don't know, especially programming events. There's just, you know, for programming conferences, that industry is definitely male dominated. You would think that there'd be more women at design like events, and there tend to be, and things like that. And you know, that's just the way it is. I didn't make the rules, and that just seems to be the way it is, unfortunately.
Okay, before we get into another controversy, it's probably time to wrap.
Yeah.
Any last comments? No, maybe that's a bad question too.
Anything else you want to? Let's take us out. You know, Jason, if there's anything else you want to leave people with, a lot of people listen to these shows and they get a great deal of inspiration listening to people like you who are, you know, incredibly successful and had a lot of hard work to create the kind of luck that you've had. Is there anything you might want to leave people with who are listening to this who are saying, you know, how do I get there? What's that first step that I can take in changing my own life or environment or job? What kind of advice do you have for anybody?
A couple things I would say. Don't make things hard on yourself. I think that so many people are making things hard on themselves all day long. And my general feeling is that things are pretty easy until you make them hard. And so what I mean by that is whatever idea you have, like the simple version of it first. Of course, there's a million things you can do. Pick three of those things out of the million and do those. Instead of hiring a bunch of people, don't hire anybody. Try and learn things on your own. You know, don't go out and get external money, because that's just going to make things more complicated. And like, just don't do the things that make things more complicated. Just do the simpler things, the easier things first. There's no shame in taking the easy way out. I think that, you know, I wrote an article in Inc. I'm running a monthly column now, which has been pretty interesting to go through that process and work with an editor and the whole thing and write things in longer form. And one of the things I talked about in my first article was about how there's a really good ROI on laziness. I'm lazy, inherently lazy about certain things, and then very motivated and driven about other things. But you should embrace some things that you're lazy about, because it will typically force you into just doing the simpler thing, because you don't want to waste time doing the hard thing, and hard things are hard. And so don't run away from that side of you if you have that side. And the last thing I'll say is that less, and this is related, but less is always an option. So there's always a simpler version. There's always a version of whatever you're doing that has less things. Maybe it's less words in a sentence. Maybe it's less sentences in a paragraph. Maybe it's less pages in a proposal. There's always, less is always an option. It's not something you should turn away from and say, well, less means it's not going to be as good, or people aren't going to take me seriously or professionally or whatever. If you're concise, you know, that's what people really want. They want concise, they want brevity, they want clarity, and oftentimes those things are related to just doing fewer things and doing less things and just doing those things better. So it's kind of a general, you know, it's a general thing. It's not like a step one, two, three bit of advice, but keep in your head that there's always a simpler version. There's always a version with fewer objects and fewer items, and less is always an option. And take it up sometimes and give it a shot, and you'll probably find out that all the things you thought you needed to do, you didn't really need to do. And it was just a few things that you really needed to do. And if you do those things well, you're way ahead of the game, because most people aren't focused on just doing a few things well. They're trying to do a whole bunch of stuff, and they're not going to do all that stuff really well. So that's your advantage, and go for it.
Wow. Jason, thanks so much for being a guest on the show today.
Real pleasure to be with both of you guys. I like both of you guys quite a bit. So thanks again. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Jason. Awesome.
All right. See you guys.
Thanks again to my co-host, Jeffrey Zeltman, and to our guest, Jason Fried. Thanks also to our sponsor, MailChimp.com, for making this show possible. And thanks to you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, please consider rating the show on iTunes. It's the best way to help new listeners find out about the show. And be sure to stop by 5x5.tv to learn more about this and all of our other programs. This is Dan Benjamin for The Big Web Show. We'll see you again next week.